Freedom and Virtue Institute presents Readings in the Freedom and Virtue Tradition, hosted by Director of Research, Kevin Schmiesing.
One of the hallmarks of Western civilization since the advent of Christianity is the emergence of a strong distinction between spiritual authority and temporal authority, between church and state. Whether this can or ought to be understood as a separation or some other conception is a contentious matter that won't detain us here. What is clear is that the insistence of Christian institutions on the prerogatives of the church has been one crucial element in reining in the absolutist tendencies of the state. Over the vast temporal and geographical scope of Christian history, this has been expressed and applied differently at various times and places, but the basic concept has remained intact. The First Amendment of the American Bill of Rights can be seen as one incarnation of the idea, with ongoing contemporary relevance. In this installment of the Freedom and Virtue Tradition series, we'll take a look at a few notable instances of papal statements on this subject across the centuries. We begin in the 5th century with a letter of Pope Gelasius I to Emperor Anastasius Augustus. Gelasius, who was pope from 492 to 496, articulated the existence of two distinct powers, the sacred and the royal. Gelasius also argued that even though the two are distinct, the spiritual power is superior by its nature. This also would be a consistent theme in papal statements. The second excerpt is from the papal bull Unum Sanctum, issued by Pope Boniface VIII in 1302. In the midst of a dispute with the King of France, who was seeking greater power for the monarchy, the Pope reiterated Gelasius's distinction, now using the venerable image of the two swords, a reference to the Gospel of Luke chapter 22, where Jesus' followers inform him they have two swords, and he replies, "It is enough." Boniface's formulation of the relationship between church and state reflects the expansive view of papal power dominant in the Middle Ages, but the fundamental distinction between sacred and secular persists. Finally, there is Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Immortali Dei, 1885. The situation had changed dramatically from the time of Boniface almost 600 years earlier. The church had been divested of the papal states, and the church's authority had been under assault in many historically Catholic places since the French Revolution. Yet Leo reiterates the timeless teaching on both the distinction between secular and sacred authority and the primacy of the sacred. The passage comes to a close with the Pope's reference to Christ's famous admonition from Mark 12:17. The free and virtuous society depends on widespread acceptance of the principle that Caesar is not God, and that the state should not demand the kind of fealty that is owed to the Creator alone. The second paragraph of the letter of Pope Gelasius to Emperor Anastasius Augustus, 494, Famuli Vestrae Pietatis, as presented at Fordham University's Internet History Sourcebooks Project. "There are two powers, August Emperor, by which this world is chiefly ruled, namely, the sacred authority of the priests and the royal power. Of these, that of the priests is the more weighty, since they have to render an account for even the kings of men in the divine judgment. You are also aware, dear son, that while you are permitted honorably to rule over humankind, yet in things divine you bow your head humbly before the leaders of the clergy, and await from their hands the means of your salvation. In the reception and proper disposition of the heavenly mysteries, you recognize that you should be subordinate rather than superior to the religious order, and that in these matters you depend on their judgment rather than wish to force them to follow your will. If the ministers of religion, recognizing the supremacy granted you from heaven in matters affecting the public order, obey your laws, lest otherwise they might obstruct the course of secular affairs by irrelevant considerations, with what readiness should you not yield them obedience to whom is assigned the dispensing of the sacred mysteries of religion? Accordingly, just as there is no slight danger in the case of the priests if they refrain from speaking when the service of the divinity requires, so there is no little risk for those who disdain, which God forbid, when they should obey. And if it is fitting that the hearts of the faithful should submit to all priests in general who properly administer divine affairs, how much the more is obedience due to the bishop of that see which the Most High ordained to be above all others, and which is consequently dutifully honored by the devotion of the whole church. Pope Boniface VIII, Unum Sanctum, 1302, the second paragraph, as presented at Papal Encyclicals Online. We venerate this church as one, the Lord having said by the mouth of the prophet, "Deliver, O God, my soul from the sword, and my only one from the hand of the dog." He has prayed for his soul, that is for himself, heart and body, and this body, that is to say, the church, he has called one, because of the unity of the spouse, of the faith, of the sacraments, and of the charity of the church. This is the tunic of the Lord, the seamless tunic, which was not rent, but which was cast by lot. Therefore, of the one and only church there is one body and one head, not two heads like a monster. That is, Christ and the vicar of Christ, Peter and the successor of Peter, since the Lord speaking to Peter himself said, "Feed my sheep," meaning my sheep in general, not these nor those in particular, whence we understand that he entrusted all to Peter. Therefore, if the Greeks or others should say that they are not confided to Peter and to his successors, they must confess not being the sheep of Christ, since our Lord says in John, "There is one sheepfold and one shepherd." We are informed by the texts of the Gospels that in this church and in its power are two swords, namely the spiritual and the temporal. For when the apostles say, "Behold, here are two swords," that is to say, in the church, since the apostles were speaking, the Lord did not reply that there were too many, but sufficient. Certainly the one who denies that the temporal sword is in the power of Peter has not listened well to the word of the Lord commanding, "Put up thy sword into thy scabbard." Therefore, both are in the power of the church, namely, the spiritual sword and the material. But indeed, the latter is to be exercised on behalf of the church, and truly the former is to be exercised by the church. The former is of the priest, the latter is by the hand of kings and soldiers, but at the will and sufferance of the priest. Pope Leo XIII, Immortale Dei, 1885, numbers 11 through 14, as presented at the Vatican's website, vatican.va. In very truth, Jesus Christ gave to his apostles unrestrained authority in regard to things sacred, together with the genuine and most true power of making laws, as also with the twofold right of judging and of punishing, which flow from that power. "All power is given to me in heaven and on earth, going therefore teach all nations, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you." And in another place, "If he will not hear them, tell the church." And again, "In readiness to revenge all disobedience." And once more, "That I may not deal more severely according to the power which the Lord hath given me, unto edification and not unto destruction." Hence it is the church and not the state that is to be man's guide to heaven. It is to the church that God has assigned the charge of seeing to and legislating for all that concerns religion, of teaching all nations, of spreading the Christian faith as widely as possible. In short, of administering freely and without hindrance, in accordance with her own judgment, all matters that fall within its competence. Now this authority, perfect in itself and plainly meant to be unfettered, so long assailed by a philosophy that truckles to the state, the Church has never ceased to claim for herself and openly to exercise. The apostles themselves were the first to uphold it, when being forbidden by the rulers of the synagogue to preach the gospel, they courageously answered, "We must obey God rather than men." This same authority the Holy Fathers of the Church were always careful to maintain by weighty arguments, according as occasion arose, and the Roman pontiffs have never shrunk from defending it with unbending constancy. Nay, more, princes and all invested with power to rule have themselves approved it, in theory alike and in practice. It cannot be called in question that in the making of treaties, in the transaction of business matters, in the sending and receiving ambassadors, and in the interchange of other kinds of official dealings, they have been wont to treat with the Church as with a supreme and legitimate power. And assuredly, all ought to hold that it was not without a singular disposition of God's providence that this power of the Church was provided with a civil sovereignty as the surest safeguard of her independence. The Almighty, therefore, has given the charge of the human race to two powers, the ecclesiastical and the civil, the one being set over divine and the other over human things. Each in its kind is supreme. Each has fixed limits within which it is contained, limits which are defined by the nature and special object of the province of each, so that there is, we may say, an orbit traced out within which the action of each is brought into play by its own native right. But inasmuch as each of these two powers has authority over the same subjects, and as it might come to pass that one and the same thing, related differently, but still remaining one and the same thing, might belong to the jurisdiction and determination of both, therefore God, who foresees all things, and who is the author of these two powers, has marked out the course of each in right correlation to the other. For the powers that are ordained of God. Were this not so, deplorable contentions and conflicts would often arise, and not infrequently. Men, like travelers at the meeting of two roads, would hesitate in anxiety and doubt, not knowing what course to follow. Two powers would be commanding contrary things, and it would be a dereliction of duty to disobey either of the two. But it would be most repugnant to them to think thus of the wisdom and goodness of God. Even in physical things, albeit of a lower order, the Almighty has so combined the forces and springs of nature with tempered action and wondrous harmony that no one of them clashes with any other, and all of them most fitly and aptly work together for the great purpose of the universe. There must accordingly exist between these two powers a certain orderly connection, which may be compared to the union of the soul and body in man. The nature and scope of that connection can be determined only, as we have laid down, by having regard to the nature of each power, and by taking account of the relative excellence and nobleness of their purpose. One of the two has for its proximate and chief object the well-being of this mortal life, the other the everlasting joys of heaven. Whatever, therefore, in things human is of a sacred character, whatever belongs either of its own nature or by reason of the end to which it is referred, to the salvation of souls or to the worship of God, is subject to the power and judgment of the Church. Whatever is to be ranged under the civil and political order is rightly subject to the civil authority. Jesus Christ has himself given command that what is Caesar's is to be rendered to Caesar, and that what belongs to God is to be rendered to God.
Thank you for listening to this production of the Freedom and Virtue Institute. To offer feedback or suggestions for future episodes, please contact Kevin Schmiesing by email. Kevin@fvinstitute.org.